Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. For Pride Month, we have a bisexual icon. You will not have heard of this person, but you are going to love her, as clearly did nearly everyone she came into contact with. She was Katarina Koopman, known as Toto. She was Dutch Javanese, born in Southeast Asia, and she had an extraordinary life as a model, a socialite, an actor, a spy, an art dealer, and an archaeologist. Anytime anyone from now on asks you a question about who you'd invite to your historical dinner party, any person from any period, you need to clear one of your guests out, because Toto is going straight on that table, and you'll see why. She was a spy for the Allies during the Second World War. She was imprisoned in Ravensbrück concentration camp. She had many, many adventures, and you've got to listen up to find out how it all ends. Tell me all about this remarkable woman. I got Marika Biagio. She is an award-winning novelist. She specialised in historical fiction, and she has spent a long time researching the life of this remarkable person, who moved effortlessly through the upper echelons of European society. So with senior politicians, press magnates, and aristocrats falling madly in love with her. And she also experienced the horrors of fascist imprisonment and torture. So here's Marika tell us about a bisexual icon. Enjoy.
T-10.
Atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
God save the king.
No black-white unity till there is first some black unity.
Never to go to war with one another again.
And liftoff, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Marika, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Glad to be here with you.
This feels very modern, this story, right? You don't associate this with the dusty early 20th century.
You're right. She was a very modern woman, Toto Koopman. And it's surprising that we don't know more about her, actually.
She spends her life in the Dutch colonies in Southeast Asia, Java. What does she do? Does she just leave that behind?
Yes, she was born in 1908 in Java, which was then occupied by the Dutch, part of the Dutch Empire, to a Dutch officer in the cavalry, and to an Indonesian mother, a Javanese mother. So she was biracial. She had an older brother there, was brought up until the age of 12, when her parents, who were very progressive and wanted to see her well-educated, sent her to the Netherlands to complete her education. So she's 12 years old in 1920. They put her on a passenger ship all by herself. She goes to the Netherlands, starts boarding school there. She never saw her parents again. She was an excellent student. She excelled at languages. She became very fluent in Dutch, French, German, Italian, and English. And those who spoke to her in those other languages said she spoke them impeccably, without even the hint of an accent.
And would she have been accepted? Was it reasonably normal for kids from the colonies to come back and be educated in the Netherlands, and particularly of mixed race kids?
it wasn't uncommon. But since she was biracial, she would have been known in Java as a green Dutchman and would have faced some prejudice, although I believe her parents cushioned her somewhat because they were very proud of their children and they recognized her intellect and her self-confidence. But she did face some discrimination when she came to the Netherlands. However, again, her supreme self-confidence saw her through. During her years in boarding school, she carved out a place as a very unique individual. For instance, one of the family friends of her father's family in Holland, she spent time with them. They had two daughters her age, and these daughters would often go to Paris and bought the latest fashions. And Tota was very influenced by that. So she would wear the latest fashions to school. And she did not wear her hair in the long braided style that was common of Dutch girls at this time. And a teacher once took her aside and said, "You know, you don't really need to dress like that and act so different from everybody else." And Tota said, "I don't dress for anybody but myself." And that was like her mantra. She pleased herself.
Well, she moved to Paris in the 1920s. She was still pretty young when she did that, right?
Yes, this would have been 1928. She was about 19 years old. She had finished her schooling. She moved to Paris. Paris was a city of much allure to her. And she, in short order, found a job working for Vogue. She became a model for Vogue, was sometimes on the cover of Vogue. She was an extremely elegant woman with very distinctive looks. She became the first biracial model to really become famous and attain a certain degree of celebrity. She was photographed by some of the best photographers in Europe. She worked with Coco Chanel for a short time. She apparently did not like the way Coco touched her, so she left Coco Chanel's employ after only 6 months and went on to work with some of the best designers in Europe at that time, wearing their fashions to parties. She was very celebrated in Paris, though she herself was not well-to-do. She was subsisting on a model's salary. She really rubbed elbows with the wealthy, with the artistic community, with politicians, ambassadors. She was very sought after. She openly espoused her bisexuality. She had affairs with men and women. Tallulah Bankhead was one of her more torrential affairs. They appeared together in public, and it was somewhat scandalous for women to showcase their sexuality at this time. And here she's not only showing that she's a sexual being, but she's a bisexual being. It was somewhat shocking, but the circles that she ran in did not look twice at her. She was well accepted in those circles.
So Tallulah Bankhead was one of the stars. People recognize her from some Alfred Hitchcock films. She was a star of Hollywood at the time.
Yes.
And so she's sort of splitting her time between London, Paris. I mean, she's traveling widely at these halcyon pre-World War II days.
Exactly. She was a great lover of opera. And she traveled the European continent, going to La Scala, Vienna, all the great opera houses. She became an aficionado of the opera, and this was a lifelong interest of hers. And because she was multilingual, she was able to move around Germany, Italy, France, Austria very easily. And she cultivated friendships in all these cities. She moved to London around 1933. She became tired of work as a model. And a lot of people were interested at this time in the movie industry. And Alexander Korda was producing a film in London, The Many Lives of Don Juan. She auditioned for and was brought on for a role in that movie. And she shot several scenes. And then she got tired of that, too. She felt like there was too much waiting around and that it was only a small step up from modeling. So her contract was terminated, and she did not appear in the movie. But interestingly, they used some of the shots of her to promote this movie. So she's moved to London and continues with this bon vivant lifestyle of hers. And she becomes interested in politics while she's in London. She sees Adolf Hitler rising to power in Germany. She sees the winds of change and totalitarianism sweeping the continent, and she becomes very concerned about this. And around this time, she meets Lord Beaverbrook. Beaverbrook was the William Randolph Hearst of England. He owned numerous newspapers. He was extremely wealthy. He was about 55 when they met, and she was about 25, and they became lovers. And he was glad to see her traveling around Europe because he was also very interested in the political scene. And she began to gather information for him because she would go to Berlin and she would listen to what was happening and what people were saying about the political winds in Germany. And Beaverbrook was only too happy to have her reports. It is even reputed, though there is no proof, that she went with him when he met with Hitler and Ribbentrop in Berlin, and also when Lord Beaverbrook went to Italy and met with Mussolini and his son. Some claim that she was his interpreter at these meetings, but we don't have any clear evidence of this. She spoke very little about her experiences during World War II afterwards because the war was a very, very traumatic experience for her. But she became fascinated with world politics, and Lord Beaverbrook was kind of her mentor with respect to politics. And it was through him that she met Stuart Menzies, who was in the British Secret Intelligence Service at the time. And he was a model for the supervisor of James Bond. And it was through him that she learned many of the techniques of a good spy.
Just before we come on to the spying, things are a little complicated in the Beaverbrook family, didn't they?
Oh, yes, indeed. Here she is having an affair with Lord Beaverbrook and meets Lord Beaverbrook's dashing son, Max. They fall in love.
A pilot, an ace pilot.
Yes, he became a pilot in the RAF and he flew during the war. So they embark on a relationship, at which point Toto, of course, leaves Lord Beaverbrook. Well, he finds out about this relationship and he is absolutely raving mad about this. He uses his newspapers to smear her. He shuns both of the couples. He uses as much influence as he can to exclude them from his high society circles. Basically, what happens is people learn not to invite Lord Beaverbrook and his son to the same parties. So they go on to live kind of separate lives, Max and his father. Beaverbrook actually bribes Toto into not marrying Max and promises her he will give her a lifetime allowance if she promises this. Well, Toto was a confirmed bachelorette. She, if anybody called her Madame, she corrected them and said, it is Mademoiselle. She vowed to never marry. So she took his money. But Max did want to marry her. They lived together for 4 years. She adamantly refused to marry him. And their relationship dissolved over that around 1939.
You're listening to Dan Snow's History. We're hearing all about Toto Koopman. An amazing woman. More coming up.
Sing, muses. Sing to me a history of Olympus. and the deathless gods who govern earth, sea, and sky. That is Zeus's command.
It's the Ancients from History Hit. I'm Tristan Hughes, your host, and every month on the podcast, we're taking a deep dive into the Olympian gods.
None of them are as simple or as single-faceted as we've kind of reduced them to in our heads when we think about the gods of the pantheon who do one thing each.
With world-leading experts, we'll be telling the dramatic story of who they are.
Aphrodite was the goddess of love and sex and passion, and specifically she was considered often to be love itself.
The myths and their meanings.
Hephaestus was already there, and that he split Zeus's head with an axe in order to liberate Athena from Zeus's head.
And how they've influenced the course of history.
Imagine ourselves back in the footsteps of people who are trying to explain and understand a world around them. A world which is not fair or just. That gets us into absolute key facet of how to understand the ancient Greek gods, which is that they are not good people.
Join us as we explore some of the most fascinating deities history has ever known. Listen and follow on The Ancients from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is After Dark, myths, misdeeds, and the paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest, and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday, and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark, myths, misdeeds, and the paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So let's get back to the spying. She goes to Italy and plays an important role there.
Yes, she moves to Florence, ostensibly to join some friends there who are art collectors. And she meets and falls in love with a man in the Italian resistance. So this is her entree into the politics in Italy. And she begins spying for the Italian resistance and also for the Allies. So we're on the eve of World War II. And she's there, and then France and Britain declare war on Germany over this invasion. The British had decided at this early point that they were not going to involve or hire women as spies, but Toto would hear none of that. She said, "I don't care if you hire me officially or not. I have secrets, and here, I'm sharing them with you." Also at this time, she had had an affair with Randolph Churchill, Winston Churchill's son. So she had an avenue into the higher powers in Britain, and she simply took on the role of a spy without having the official imprimatur of the British government.
Did she produce useful intelligence, and was it dangerous work?
It was dangerous work. She traveled around Italy. She actually had an affair with Galeazzo Ciano, Mussolini's son-in-law. although he was careful not to provide her with state secrets, she would often go to meetings of the black shirts and the fascists in Italy. She had a very good friend there, Elizabeth Eichmann, who was an art student in Italy and had left Germany because she was unhappy with the political currents there. Toto and Elizabeth would go to fascist meetings. And so Toto would be taking mental notes about the strategies that the fascists were using to drum up support within Italy. And in this way, she did learn some important things. She learned, for instance, about the design of one of the tanks that Italy was using and drew up a design of this tank and passed it back along to the Brits.
And Ciano was not only Mussolini's son-in-law, he's also his foreign secretary, right? So she would have been mixing in very important circles. Wow.
Yes, he was the foreign minister for Mussolini, and he would have been Ribbentrop's counterpart.
How did it end for her? Did she manage to navigate that well?
She was arrested in Florence by the fascist government. She was afraid at first that they had found out about her spying activities. As it turned out, however, they arrested her because of her prominence. They knew that she had celebrity status and that she had moved freely around Europe. They were trying to recruit her to spy for Italy and Germany. She adamantly refused to do this. So she was imprisoned, and she was moved around among three different camps, detention camps in Italy. And finally, after a few years, again, she kept refusing to cooperate. She refused to give them any information. And at one of the camps, she met a man called Rospigliosi, who was himself a part of the Italian resistance. And he was being brutally tortured. And while they were trying to extract the names of other collaborators from him, and Toto realized this man will not live if they continue this interrogation, she managed to get him out of the camp. She was instrumental in moving him into freedom. And they later met, and he was very grateful to her for saving his life. But she did finally escape after a couple of years in these camps and fled to Venice and continued her intelligence gathering ways for a time in Venice. In fact, she was stowing away at the Hotel Danieli in Venice, which is still much the same as it was during the war years. And she got word that the Germans who occupied the city of Venice was saved from bombing because the Germans moved into Venice early on and occupied it. But she was informed that the Germans were going to be searching Hotel Danieli. And she was afraid to leave because they were surrounding the hotel as a prelude to conducting this search. So one of her friends in Venice actually called a dinner party of some of the higher ranking Venetians, including some German officers, and brought Toto to this meeting so that she was kind of hiding in plain sight and escaped notice while the Germans thoroughly searched the Hotel Danieli. Now, unfortunately, a few days later, somebody betrayed her and she was arrested on the streets in Venice by the German government.
And she ended up in Ravensbrück concentration camp.
Yes, she was transported by train to Ravensbrück, which was the largest concentration camp for women only in Germany, a little north of Berlin, very cold. She arrived there in October of 1944, and the conditions there were far worse than anything she had experienced at the detention camps in Italy, as you can imagine. I mean, there were a lot of Jewish women there, but there were also many other women. They had a large number of Polish women. Polish women probably predominated among the captives at Ravensbrück. Food was very scarce. She lost a lot of weight. And in a bid to both survive and try to help other captives there, she claimed that she was a nurse. She claimed she had been educated at a nursing school in London, and she knew that the Nazis would not be able to corroborate this because, of course, they weren't going to be able to get any information from the English about this. So she successfully got herself placed as a nurse in the infirmary, which was not really an infirmary so much as a unit in which a lot of experimentation was done. One of the experiments that the Nazis did was on infecting wounds. They would wound women in the legs, and then they would infect their wounds with various awful substances. And then they would do experiments to see which kinds of agents had antibiotic qualities and would heal. So they were using this for their own, you know, medical knowledge. So Toto saw this experimentation. She herself also was sterilized while they were there. This is another thing that they were doing. And because she was biracial, she was sterilized along with some very young girls. Toto did some very courageous things while she was there. Many of the women in this supposed infirmary were among the weakest in the camp. Regularly, the truck would come around to cart them off to the crematorium. And she often manipulated some of the records so that she could hold back some of the women who she thought had a chance of surviving. And she would sometimes lie about the numbers of dead that day so that she could hide some of the people and claim that they had already died. And if it had become known that she was doing these things, she likely would have been shot on the spot. So she again showed her courage, and she was a very principled person, had a lot of empathy for others.
Astonishing, astonishing story. She got out of Ravensbrück and ended up in a Red Cross camp, and then there's a very interesting gentleman comes to retrieve her.
Yes, she was freed as Ravensbrück was liberated and taken to Sweden by the Red Cross. She's very emaciated at this point. Her hair was cut off, so her hair is very choppy. And Randolph Churchill, her old flame, comes to her aid. He brings her a wig. He brings her stylish clothes, even though they hang on her skeletal frame. And he brings her money to help her get started again.
And so this is Winston Churchill's son?
Yes, this is Winston Churchill's son.
Extraordinary.
Who comes to her aid and helps nurse her through her stay at the Red Cross.
Her post-war life is almost as interesting. She becomes a hugely important patron of artists, and seems to me she lived the most extraordinary life. Do you think she found her place? Did she find happiness eventually? Was she always moving and searching?
I think she did. After Sweden, she moved to Ascona, Switzerland. She thought this would be a peaceful place. And there she met Erika Brausson, who fell in love with her. And they were lovers, partners for the rest of their lives, until Toto's death in 1991. Erika was a great patron of the arts, and she was just embarking on the founding of an art gallery in London. And she convinced Toto to move to London with her and open a gallery. Now, Toto was still very frail and very shaken. I mean, the war experience did have a profound impact on her, but Erika loved her deeply and did everything she could to bring Toto back to her vivacious lifestyle. And they opened this gallery near Hanover Square in London and called it Hanover Gallery. Erica Brawson had come across an artist who was doing very modern and groundbreaking work at this time. Nobody recognized this or wanted his art, but she was fascinated by his work. This is Francis Bacon. And she started showing his art in her gallery. You know, we know him now today as one of the groundbreaking people of the modern art movement. So her gallery became probably one of the top three galleries in all of Europe. In later years, she opened a gallery in Geneva. So she had two galleries, and she was a very successful art dealer. She herself was a somewhat brusque person. So Toto became kind of the face of the gallery and managed all the openings and the parties. The gallery became much more than a gallery. It became a salon where all of the, a lot of artistic people, painters, writers frequented this place. And Toto kept all the contacts up. She did all the invitations to their events. So she really helped manage this gallery while Erica did the work of scouting out new art. Together, they were very successful art dealers.
What a wonderful, albeit traumatic, no doubt, and terrifying life journey that woman went on. She's extraordinary.
She absolutely was. And I think she didn't speak much about the war afterwards. She wanted to leave it behind.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Tell everyone what the book is called.
My novel is called The Model Spy, and it focuses on Toto's World War II experience.
Well, thank you very much, Marika Biagio, for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Dan.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.